Yes, thank you very much. Also welcome to this afternoon session. We will continue with the physics of spinor quantum gas systems after we already heard the talk on this topic prior to lunch. But first, of course, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this really fascinating meeting here, also to this very nice place, first time here in South California. It's pretty relaxing conditions. So I will first give you a short introduction to these spinor quantum gas systems, more a bit from the experimentalist point of view. And then I will focus on two subjects. The first subject will be ground state properties as well as dynamics in rubidium spinor Bose-Einstein condensates in the FX1 as well as FX2 state. And they will see this is basically physics at as low temperature as we can get, so to reduce finite temperature effects. Whereas the second or third part of this talk will then concentrate on finite temperature effects. They will see rather new aspects of multi-component thermodynamics that was not yet studied that much before. We see surprising effects as condensate melting, magnetization of a condensate driven by temperature, or also kind of new paths to BEC, where we'll see this is not new, this is actually Einstein's original idea. Well, so what is our system? Already mentioned, it's a multi-component spinor quantum gas system. Multi-component here means that we work with the different MF levels that we have present in the hyperfine ground state of the alkali atoms. So in F equals 1 case, we have 3 different MF levels, of course. F equals 2, we have even 5 levels. And these systems appear to show up very rich dynamics, very rich characteristics, and that is due to basically two aspects. The first is we have all several different interactions, and I will come to the kind of interactions in a minute. We have interaction within different condensate components, so we have these different MF components. This is a kind of picture. This is not a real picture. They do not look like this in real space. They're just to kind of give you an imagination. So this should be condensate. We have 3 different components here, even 5 different condensate components over here. And of course, they all interact with each other. And sometimes they, of course, superpose to each other. In the antiferromagnetic case, they try to separate, whatever. And we have the interaction of all those condensate components with the normal component that, of course, also consists of, in this case, 5 different components. And this already gives rather complicated ground state properties and very rich dynamics. The second aspect is we do have exchange of population. So it's not that all these components are constant, but for example, these MF equals 0 components can undergo transition out into plus and minus 1 components. And so the whole talk will be on these systems. And therefore, first, let me define again what are the relevant interactions in our system. This is indeed small differences in the weak interactions in the quantum gases. Or to be more precise, it is the small difference in the S-wave scattering lengths describing collisions of two atoms with different total spin involved in this collision. So two atoms with MF equals 0 have a different S-wave scattering length than if the two atoms are both in plus MF 1 state, so having total spin 2 within this collision. And as these are bosons that we are currently dealing with, the total spin within a two-particle collision can only be an even number. So for F equals 1, we only have the scattering length A0, total spin 0, or A2, total spin 2. Whereas in the case F equals 2, we even have a third scattering length that is with total spin 4. And as you can see from those numbers, the differences in the different S-wave scattering lengths are rather small, in the order of 3% over here, slightly larger, 6 to 8% over here. But it's that very small difference in S-wave scattering lengths that completely then determines the dynamics and the ground state properties. And this was, of course, already very much pointed out by the MIT group, Wolfram Catalyst group, in the pioneering experiments on the spinor Bose-Einstein condensates in sodium atoms. Well, extremely important to realize, and this is then what came up in the discussion after the last talk. Here in this situation, we have an isolated system, an isolated trap separated from any other surroundings, so we do have total spin conservation. This means that within, so to say, one collisional process, two atoms in MF equals zero, they can either stay in MF equals zero, or they can undergo this transition into minus one, and then the other one has to go into plus one. They cannot both then, so to say, undergo transition from MF equals zero into plus two. So there is no spin relaxation on all relevant timescales in our systems. This is important to realize. This makes the whole thing rather very symmetric evolution with respect to the different spin orientations. Another remark, you may wonder why don't we have dipole-dipole interactions, which are of course then described by different means. But indeed, well, we do have dipole-dipole interaction, of course, present in these spinor condensates, but they are at least one order of magnitude smaller than the relevant interactions, this difference in S-wave scattering processes. And it's even very hard to see effects coming out of dipole-dipole interactions, these quantum gases. There are approaches to study this, for example, at Stuttgart University. Well, now there are two, I would say, one can classify two main branches of research with these kind of multi-component Spinor-Bose-Einstein condensates. The first branch I would like to call magnetism in quantum gases. Magnetism, of course, he used in a rather general meaning, saying that magnetism is a system with spin-dependent interaction, or where the interaction depends on spin orientation. And this work was pioneered by Jason Ho, Machida, theoretically and experimentally, as I already mentioned, both from Catalyst Group, as well as for the spin one-half system, effective spin one-half system, in the Gillet Group, Eric Cornell's group. And there was a lot of theoretical work, and I only mentioned here a few groups working theoretically in this area of Spinor-Bose-Einstein condensates. There's more. I apologize for not mentioning all. And quite recently, two other experimental groups came up studying these systems with rubidium Bose-Einstein condensates, these F equals 1, F equals 2 cases, that is our group as well as my Chapman's group, and we're going to talk about this in the next talk. And so what you basically then see, kind of observe there is kind of spin dynamics. So for example, F equals 1, we start up in an MF equals 0 case, and this is not the ground state of the system, and that what we observe is that other, so to say, spin domains build up due to the symmetric possibilities that, so to say, pairwise you get an exchange of MF equals 0 population into plus MF equals plus 1 and minus 1 population. And then there is the, or in F equals 2, I will come back to this, we even get population of all different 5 MF states. And then there's, of course, this always this question, what can be described in this system by coupled Kospiteski equation, and what is physics beyond coupled Kospiteski equation? And of course, this kind of pairwise entanglement, this is not within the framework of Kospiteski, and we already heard about this morning a very fascinating talk on quantum information applications, and it was also again Ignazio, Peter Zoller, and co-workers that studied these spin systems concerning application in quantum information. Also, we see a lot of damping within our system, so there is some kind of relaxation that will come to this, and this is of course then also usually beyond Kospiteski physics. And if you go into optical lattices, entering strong interaction regimes is completely out of this regime. All this is now in the center of interest in our work, the Georgia Tech work, and also in other groups. And then there's a second branch of physics, I think, in the Spinor condensate system that is directly connected to finite temperature physics, as you simply do have a kind of multi-component quantum gas thermodynamics, and there is not that much of theoretical work on this. It's just, okay, you have your different spin components within the condensate, and you do have all your thermal components, and you have all the different interactions, and they count differently due to quantum statistics, whether they have interact with their own, so to say, thermal cloud, or with the other thermal clouds. And this allows us then, also due to different timescales, to study a couple of new things, and I will come back to this in the second part of the talk. And there again, I would like to mention that this was studied also in this spin one-half systems by the Gila group. And as I mentioned, theory, I can't list that much over here so far. Let me give you another minute on the details of the relevant interaction in our system, just trying to make clear what's really the relevant interaction that we have to take into account. So first, within this F equals 1 or F equals 2 systems, we do have this single component mean field. that enters then the total energy function. This is not mentioned here because this is not a spin-dependent part, but it also enters total spin energy function. Then, and you see the order, this is our chemical potential is in the order of 120 nanokelvin. So I give different energy scales over here. Then, of course, we have this mean field exchange interaction. That is our most relevant thing. That is what we want to really to have in our system. And this is described also then by these spinner operators. And you see that these differences, so to say, in energy out coming out of different SV scattering lengths is in the order of only a few nanokelvin. In the case, this is for rubidium, this is a spin-dependent mean field for the F equals 1 case, and for F equals 2, you have to add an additional term, and this is even smaller here in the case of rubidium.
G1 is ferromagnetic?
G1 is just a constant. It depends on the value of G1, whether you're ferromagnetic or antiferromagnetic. I will come to this. In rubidium, this is ferromagnetic. F equals 1 turns out to be ferromagnetic. F equals 2 turns out to be antiferromagnetic. Yes. Prior to this question, what is the current state of the system? In our experiments, we always do have magnetic field presence, and we have to take care on magnetic fields. And the first huge effect would be usually, so to say, the linear Zeeman effect. If you go into the numbers, you see this is microkelvins per Gauss. So if you work at something like 100 milligauss or what, this would give you an enormous high, a couple of hundred nanokelvin, so highest energy in the system. But fortunately, this completely cancels out due to spin conservation. So if we start, for example, in this M0 case, and you see that then pairwise you have this transition into plus 1 and minus 1, so one guy gets up this huge Zeeman energy, but the other one gets down, and exactly the same value. So the total Zeeman energy does not change at all within this spin dynamic because it's always symmetric. So it always, if you start over here, it's the same, and you can't work out that you get additional Zeeman energy unless you do have, for example, MF-dependent losses. But this is, to say, then a dirty effect, and usually we can work in regimes where we don't have where we don't suffer from losses that much. Okay, so this cancels out. But what is important is the quadratic Zeeman energy. And this, in the alkali cases, they have different behavior for the F equals 1 and F equals 2 case. In F equals 1, you lower the MF equals 0 state with respect to the two other ones. So if you apply an additional homogeneous magnetic offset field, you lower this energy, and therefore you can drive actively the system, in this case, into your MF equals 0 state. So even if it's ferromagnetic, if you increase your offset field, then finally get all your population into MF equals 0, because there the system tries to lower its energy. And it's the other way around in F equals 2. Here you favor the outermost states by increasing external magnetic field. And then that is what you just came for. Out of this, minimizing this energy functional, you can get the ground state properties. And I will not go into detail into these ground state properties too much. Just for those people not used in this area, we can either have, in very simplified words, ferromagnetic case or antiferromagnetic case, where ferromagnetism, of course, then tries to build up domain structures. So to say, you can also talk about immiscible quantum gases, as it was studied in the MIT group, very much antiferromagnetic. The other way around, the system tries to cancel pairwise, so to say, the spin, you get the superposition of the spin state. So how do we now experimentally study these spinner with Einstein condensates? Well, you can't work out this in the usual magnetic trap, because there your spin is pinned in this huge magnetic trap field, but we have to work in an optical dipole trap. So we create rubidium with Einstein condensates in this finely tuned optical dipole trap, where the trapping potential is identical for all MF states. And well, usually we start in our experiment with a magnetic trap, so we come out in the low field seeking state of the magnetic trap. Then by means of radioelectric passage and Landau-Zeeman sweeps, we can create nearly arbitrary initial spin configuration. So we can, by means of application of radio frequencies, we can start with either any one of those MF components, for example, here in the F equals 2 case, or with nearly arbitrary mixture of spin components as initial condition. Okay, and then afterwards, after the state preparation, we let the whole thing evolve within this dipole trap. And this is important to realize all that happens when all these MF components are superposed in the dipole trap. And after a defined hold time, we switch off the dipole trap, and then if we have, for example, afterwards all these MF components present, we apply a Stern-Gerlach field and spatially separate these MF components. And this, of course, then allows us to get the population within these different MF components. But please realize everything relevant happens when everything is superposed. You always will see these Stern-Gerlach separated pictures, but this is just after this spatial separation for detection reasons. And typical things we do observe, for example, in the F equals 2 case, is spin dynamics. If we start up with in MF equals 0 state, what we qualitatively observe is that first the MF equals 0 atoms build up the plus 1 and minus 1 components as well due to this symmetric transfer out of MF equals 0. There could be also initially a strong population directly from MF equals 0 into plus 2 and minus 2, but that is not what's going to happen here due to different coupling constants given by the differences in S-ray scattering lengths. So the clear observation is first the MF equals 1 components build up, and then later the MF equals 2 components build up. And so this is then data showing this dynamics. So the red curve is the population in MF equals 0. This goes down on rather fast timescales of something like an order of 10 milliseconds. And then the green curve is plus minus 1. The blue curve is plus minus 2. And this is the same data. Again, the population of the spin components as a function of time. And you see there's a kind of initial delay. So the plus minus 1 come up something like after 10 milliseconds, the plus minus 2 after further 10 milliseconds. And we come to this delay on the next slide. And also what we then clearly observe is oscillation between the different spin components. And this is rather interesting. On a timescale of several hundred milliseconds, we do observe a coherent, or there has to be some coherence in the system, a macroscopic spin oscillation of our system. And qualitatively, of course, we can easily understand this. We start not in the ground state of the system. So the condensate has some additional energy, and therefore it tries to undergo a transition into the ground state, and coming from quantum optics, what's happening then is just Rabi oscillations. So the system tries to undergo a transition into the ground state, but if there is no dissipation, it can't get rid of its energy, and therefore it comes back and we observe these coherent spin oscillations. But what we also, of course, see is they are strongly damped on a time scale of 100 milliseconds, and this is indication due to interaction with a normal component at finite temperature. So this is due to finite temperature effects. So we have to differ. What can we understand out of just pure T equals zero physics? And that we can describe in coupled cross-Peterski equations. And to show you this, well, we first, just to get some easy calculation, we started up with homogeneous case, coupled cross-Peterski equation written down here for the F equals 1 case without going into detail. It's just coupled nonlinear Schrödinger equation for the three different components, plus 1, 0, and minus 1, and then two further equations for the F equals 2 case. And this is shown here. This is the simulation for the same case as we do observe here. The MF equals 0 comes down. The F equals 1 and 2 come up, and then they do oscillate with respect to each other. And what we see here in the simulation on the time scale, this is 10 milliseconds, 20 milliseconds. The MF equals 0 comes dramatically down. F equals 1 comes first up. F equals 1 then comes later. And then we get some oscillation. And in this, well, mean field approach, this will oscillate forever. And you get, as these are three components, you get a lot of revivals and a lot of things like this. But we, of course, do not see this huge revival because we have the strong damping due to finite temperature effects. In order to get any population of the other components, we have to introduce some seed into the initially empty population, because otherwise you can't populate the other components within this mean field approach. You need something like quantum fluctuations in order to first populate these things. This is the same as down conversion in usual optics. But the aspect here is we have some imperfect initial perforation, and you see the seed we need in order to get this spin dynamics to go up is in the order of 10 to minus 4. And this is easily what we have as imperfections in our initial perforation. Okay, I will not go too much into these ground state aspects, but as Mike, I think, is going to discuss this a bit more in detail, we observe here the F equals 2 case is antiferromagnetic. Antiferromagnetic means it builds, it is finally in the superposition of plus and minus 2 states that do not show up any more spin dynamics. So on a time scale of 300 milliseconds, the population in these components stays absolutely constant, and it is superposed within this optical trap, and that is what is expected for the antiferromagnetic ground state. I can't go into all the details. These are our calculation for ground state, because ground state properties of F equals 2, including the magnetic field effects, have not been calculated before. So this is a spatially, yes, this is the antiferromagnetic one is a spatially homogeneous state, whereas the ferromagnetic one tries to build up spin domains. And actually, there is a kind of interesting state existent for F equals 2 system, is called cyclic state, where you get even a more complicated phase diagram. But you can't choose, of course, you know. Whether it's ferromagnetic, antiferromagnetic, cyclic is given by nature, by the differences in SOS scattering lengths, unless you use, for example, Feshbach resonances to switch between these different behaviors. But the F equals 1 case we have also studied, and there we found it's ferromagnetic. But again, I would like to refer to the next talk. This was studied in more detail by the Jordan Tech group. And I would like to draw your attention especially, well, the green is difficult to see, unfortunately, to the different time scales. I mentioned in the F equals 2 system, we saw spin dynamics within the order of 10 milliseconds, 20 milliseconds. Here, this is now seconds. This is 10 seconds, 20 seconds. And so again, this is a population. We start in a superposition of plus minus MF plus minus 1 with 50% and no population in with some certain errors in the MF equals 0 state. And then these data and these curves should indicate that after a time of 5 seconds, nothing happens. And then sometimes we observe that the system did undergo a transition into the correct ferromagnetic mixing, so to say, but spatially probably separated. We haven't looked that much in detail to it. And these curves that should indicate to guide the eye that in between we have no data points. So it then suddenly happens, you know, for something like 8 seconds, nothing happens, for example, and then we do observe the different populations, the other components. This is a huge, very, very long time constant, and still it's, again, to mention, driven by this nano-Kelvin physics. And now this is very nice. That is what is expected. We did some measurements on this. We couldn't get some really final conclusive results on this. But I think Mike's going to discuss this more. So we haven't studied that much the spatial properties of the ferromagnetic case F equals 1. Yeah, we have a cigar-shaped trap. Yes. Okay, so in order to conclude this part, we have antiferromagnetic behavior with fast spin dynamic, with respect to thermalization in the F equals 2 state, and we have slow spin dynamics in the F equals 1 and ferromagnetic behavior. Of course, while we do have now existing a Raman laser system to coherently copy those things, so you can coherently copy a ferromagnetic with an antiferromagnetic, and there are many aspects and possible applications for quantum information applications. We have fast dynamics over here, and then you could, so to say, store entanglement out of this fast dynamics into this lower state. But these are different aspects. Let me just, within one minute, discuss a different point of view. That is that you can describe the whole thing also from quantum optics point of view as four-wave mixing. So four-wave mixing in optics is you shines, let's say, for example, two laser beams with different frequency into a nonlinear crystal, and you get out two different laser frequency. The whole process fulfills energy and momentum conservation. For Bose-Einstein condensates, this was demonstrated in Bill Phillips' group and also in other groups later. And what we have in spinor condensates is exactly the same process. We discussed this in some conferences before, and now there's also a recent paper by Burkett, the NIST theory group, where they describe exactly this process of four-wave mixing in spin over the Einstein condensates, for this, especially for the FEQ1 case. In the FEQ2, it seems to be, well, what we see is more complicated. Now we have different competing four-wave mixing channels, and so it's interesting to work this out. So to say, kind of five-wave mixing. And the nonlinear Schrodinger equation are exactly the same to describe this, these systems. So what I just showed you as a coupled Cosby-Tayeski equation is exactly the equations to describe also four-wave mixing in optics. But now the interesting aspect is if we include the interplay between kinetic energy and magnetic fields, it seems to be that we can add additional interesting processes. This all is a bit more speculative in the spirit of this meeting. There's not yet any data on this. These are a bit wild ideas, so to say. Well, let's, for example, start with atoms with two condensates in the MF equals zero case with momentum of h bar k, 2h bar k with respect to each other. So two colliding MF equals zero Bose-Einstein condensates. Well, if you now apply an additional magnetic field, so there's this quadratic Zeeman energy exactly fits to the kinetic energy of 1h bar k for each of those two guys, then of course what's going to happen is if they then finally undergo a transition into minus 1 and plus 1, they have to bring up the Zeeman energy, and this can only be taken out of the kinetic energy. And if you exactly bring this together, so this example gives you a degenerate resonant four-wave mixing process then. And so that is four-wave mixing into a zero momentum state. You know, they come together and they collide and they stand still. That is a bit of fun because you can't do this in optics. You can't do optics with zero momentum states afterwards. But what is perhaps even more interesting is, and this is purely speculative so far, if you apply a much smaller magnetic field, h bar k is a huge energy for the condensates, for excitations, but if you apply a much smaller difference then, and if you have the whole system in MF equals zero, and you have this four-wave mixing process, then, so to say, you can exactly match this different to low-lying excitations, low-lying kinetic energy, low-lying phonons. And so to say, in principle, you could think about having some kind of stimulation of this four-wave mixing process, or in other words, of spin dynamics, by the coupling to pre-existing excitations in the system, or otherwise you can even suppress if you work at a very low temperature. For example, you could perhaps couple to something like quadrupole mode, this four-wave mixing process is exactly fit with an additional homogeneous offset field, and it turns out it's quite accessible, a few Gauss, in order to then to say to stimulate this process into a quadrupole mode. And so I think there's not that much work so far on this coupling of spinodynamics to finite temperature excitations. Well, in the last 2 or 3 minutes, I would turn now to a different aspect, this kind of second branch that we study with these kind of Spinor Bose-Einstein condensates, that's finite temperature physics. And I think we all know these pictures, and we are all used to the idea that you get Bose-Einstein condensation by lowering the temperature of your system, for example, by means of evaporative cooling. And we all are used to this diagram, which shows the number of atoms in the condensate fraction normalized to total number of atoms as a function of temperature. And what you see is that at the critical temperature, you get this huge increase. So the usual way to think of is that your temperature determines the ratio of number of atoms in the condensate with respect to total number of atoms. But this is not the whole story. Because, of course, the phase space is at least two-dimensional. So you do not have only temperature, you also do have number of atoms in your system. And again, this is ground state. This is Bose-Einstein condensate fraction normalized to total number of atoms. And so this line is the line we all usually use, what you have seen in the previous slide. And the usual approach is, as I mentioned, you reduce basically temperature, while due to evaporation you lose atoms, but basically you go across this line. But you can do it the other way around. You can work at constant temperature and just increase the number of atoms in your system until you reach the critical phase space density. And from there on, this is a saturated gas. From there on, you just fill up your condensate. so that the number of atoms in the condensate then increases simply by the additional atoms you add to the system, whereas the number of atoms in the normal component stays fixed if you work at constant temperature. This is a completely different way of thinking, but of course, this is actually the oldest approach, so to say, you can think of. This is the approach within Einstein's original work from 1925. This is unfortunately in German, but he discusses what happens if I increase the density at constant temperature, and he says, well, there will be separation. One part condenses, the other part, the rest, remains a saturated ideal gas. And it's really fascinating that Einstein already worked out this remains a saturated then ideal gas. Well, we have nearly ideal gas, weakly interacting gas. But how can we now realize this experimentally? Well, we can realize this in F equals 1 system where we have this slow spin dynamics. And we use the thermal components in the MF equals minus 1 and MF equals plus 1 as a temperature reservoir, whereas we use the condensate parts, minus 1 and plus 1, as a particle reservoir. And again, everything is superposed in this dipole trap, which is just split off here to demonstrate it to you. And then it's important to realize these two aspects. The first thing is we have no relevant spin dynamics in the thermal cloud. So they are superposed, but due to the low densities, we do not observe relevant spin dynamics over there in the relevant timescales. And then we have seen on one of the initial transparencies that we have this slow spin dynamics from these MF equals minus 1 and plus 1 components in the condensate that populate, due to spin dynamics, this MF equals 0 condensate component, so within the condensate. But those guys now realize they don't have their own thermal component. They don't have their own thermal cloud. And these are distinguishable particles. No, these are MF equals 0 particles. So they first then build up, they immediately thermalize due to the interaction with the other normal components. They thermalize and build up this normal component first. And this goes on and on until also we get in MF equals 0, until we get also there the saturated ideal gas in Einstein's manner. And afterwards, then, if you see this saturated gas, then if you proceed and spin dynamic proceeds by itself to fill up this MF equals 0 component, and then we also populate the MF equals 0 condensate. So we really fill up these zero component with particles at constant temperatures, because while we see we have some small additional effects due to change of particles in temperature, but this is not the relevant most important aspect. And well, related work with finite temperature and different components, again to mention, is the Jüller work, for example. They see this decoherence driven cooling, and this is exactly what we see in the experiment. We do observe that indeed we start with partially condensed systems, something like 50% of the system in the condensate fraction in minus 1 and plus 1 thermal components. And well, even initially small condensate here due to imperfect preparation, but this is immediately melts within thermalization times of 50 milliseconds. And then those components here fill up the thermal component first until we get three identical thermal components, thermal clouds. And from then on, when this is saturated, we get the additional condensate fraction. And we have simulated this. I have no time to go into detail. We have simulated this by rate equations. Because there is no more advanced theory on this so far. And these classical rate equations, where you have included thermalization, loss processes, even evaporation, spin dynamics especially, and by hand some phase-based redistribution quantum things, we can, these simulations fit very well to our data, where we see that indeed this is a population of the thermal cloud. Red is this initially empty curve, goes up rapidly until fixes to the other population of the other thermal cloud, and then all thermal clouds stay constant. We have an overall loss process, but this is not relevant for the main dynamics, and the condensate comes up at the moment when these two curves lock together. Okay, so the main idea is, indeed, you can have a kind of saturated normal component, you can fill up more and more condensate atoms, you can get huge condensate, and the number of atoms in your thermal cloud does not change anymore in first order within this picture. Okay, we'll skip the other things. Mention that I discussed the magnetic properties of those, you know, with Einstein condensates. We have also measured high-perfine state Feshbach resonance. If you're interested, there is also our contribution to differences in positions of Feshbach resonances. And finally, discussed a bit textbook like quantum gas thermodynamics, where we will continue in further work in the investigation of coherence properties and entanglement in these Spinor Bose-Einstein condensates, so physics beyond Kospitevsky, and especially we are also interested in Spinor physics in optical lattices. And finally, let me mention the people involved in this work were the driving force, and is Kai Bongs, who's responsible for all the quantum gas projects in my group. And this was work by the two PhD students, Jorge Schmalian and Michael Erhard. They finishing their PhD in those days, and now there are two new PhD students, Jochen Kroniger, Christoph Becker, and diploma student Karl Thomas Gahl. And the final slide is this usual advertisement correlation. I think we now all show how interesting the place is where we work. So this is a very, very nice city of Hamburg. And I can guarantee you there are very moderate temperatures. So you never come to a huge sweet transpiration in this city. So even in summer, the temperatures are very nice, and also in winter, or in other words, it's usually very cold there, so there's high motivation to go into the lab. But indeed, it's a nice city to work in. Okay, and with this, I thank you for your attention.
Okay, questions and comments?
Thanks. You say that you create a constant in MF equals zero state.
For example,
yes. I'm wondering if it's really a separate constant from the other two, which I think you have in MF equals one and minus one. So would you see three constants, or would you see just one constant? In other words, are they phase coherent?
But indeed, the dynamics depend on the, I'm not sure whether I understand your question correctly. The dynamics that we observe depends on the initial preparation. So for example, in F equals 1, the ground state is a ferromagnetic ground state, and there we expect in the ground state a superposition of all three components, and the amount of population of the three different components depends on the additional magnetic offset field, due to this additional quadratic Zeeman effect.
Right. What I'm just asking is, if you do the usual Penrose-Onsaga criterion, do you see three separate eigenvalues, or do you see just one?
Get the question, maybe. The other way to phrase the question is, suppose I measure the number of fluctuations between different components, and one,
yes, okay, yes, yes, actually, yeah, okay. Well, I think I should pass over this question to the next talk, because this was indeed observed in Georgia Tech, that due to this entanglement process, you do see reduced number fluctuations in the other components. So if you start in MF equals 0, you do see very much reduced number fluctuation in the difference of population of plus one, minus one, indeed.
Just a comment. I think that if you have a non-condensate cloud, a thermal cloud, the issue of coherence between the different M levels affects the dynamics quite a bit.
Yes.
In a condensate, it affects it hardly at all.
Yes, indeed. I mean, this is actually what we're going to learn basically from your work. And we looked in these kind of thermodynamic aspects also for this kind of decoherence-driven cooling. We don't see this in our system that much, because the other effects dominate that this thing. But it's expected, and this is what we would like to look in future in more detail, the dependency of the, for example, spin oscillations on temperature.
I have a question about how to control the temperature. Can you lower it? Since I think from my viewpoint, the really interesting spin dynamics would be the one at t equals zero, because it's less complicated. I think one should understand first. And is there any way to further lower temperature, or are there some intrinsic problems that you see in experiments that would prevent one to go to lower temperatures? The other question is, that at the end you show that you can have one and minus one convert to zero. So during this process, are there temperature oscillations, as far as you can tell? because then I could.
Yeah, okay, yes. Well, indeed, perhaps let me go to this transparency. Well, the usual temperature we achieve, I would say, is connected to the usual problems you do have in the lab to go to lowest temperatures. So it rather critically depends on your evaporation process, on finally it is in the optical trap that you don't get any additional technical heating in your optical trap, that you reduce the optical trap high that you get some further evaporation and so on. And the best you can get, well, we can also go down to temperatures where we can't resolve the thermal cloud within our detection. So the usual things that you have condensate fraction above 80% or even 85%, or let's say 80% for sure. And then to go further is difficult. There is one means that is due to the different time scales here in the system. For example, in this example, which is a kind of realization condensate melting, we start in the FEQ2 manifold in a superposition of -1 and +1. And then within a couple of 5 to 10 milliseconds, we populate the initially empty states and we populate the condensate part. There's very few thermal cloud because this happens on 5 milliseconds. And if there's initially no atoms in normal component, so you can think of well, first populating just the condensate and then getting rid out of the other components by applying additional magnetic field, having a resonant process, repelling all the atoms in those initial state, including the thermal components, so kind of purification of pure condensate fractions. You can at least think of those concepts. These are given here, because later then what happens here, we get first the condensate and then they melt because they realize they don't have their own thermal cloud. This is another example of this finite temperature thermodynamics. This is another nice aspect. So this opens, we would say, a whole door to multi-component thermodynamics. This is the Azure regime. You first build up condensates up here, and then they are in contact with the other normal clouds, and then they are melted because they are not within the ideal saturated gas at the correct temperature.
What happens with the initial?
Well, the initial thermal cloud it depends on the amount of particles you have in the initial thermal cloud. You have a change of temperature in the system because you release particles, the system adapts due to all. So the individual, just due to individual quantum statistics, Bose statistics. In this case, the temperature, the temperature goes down. Because you out of these condensates, you fill up other condensate components, so you fill up these condensates by out of the thermal cloud, and therefore the temperature decreases in this case.
On that last slide, and this is a general question, what is the orientation of your trap with respect to the pictures here?
Okay, we have sigma-shaped traps in its horizontal. The horizontal axis and the quantization axis is in this horizontal direction then, along the long axis of condensates.
And the other question was regarding the F equals 1 mixing that happens at a slow time scale in your experiment.
Yes.
And that's starting from superposition or a mixture of +1 and -1. Have you also looked at starting with the zero state?
Well, actually, when we start purely in the zero state, we saw sometimes state behavior, slightly strange behavior. In a lot of cases, we couldn't observe a full buildup of the Kahn state, the expected Kahn state. And this may be due to some limitation of spin dynamics due to the spatial effects that you first need this spatial separation to build up these components, and this can't happen if you start purely in an FEQ0 component. We have a few data where it did happen, but in most of the data it did not happen. So therefore we have not fully conclusive interpretation of this aspect. It's very much, I would say, related to what was observed in Wolf and Kettler's work, where they, of course, studied in detail the spatial buildup of spin domains, the tunneling between the spin domains and all that was in the initial MIT work.
If I understand correctly, the spin dynamics of your condensate is completely classical. So I'm curious about your final statement on entanglement.
Well, I wouldn't say it's classical. Well, you start out of one coherent macroscopic wave function,
yes,
and you build up first for t equals 0 coherent other wave function, and you get a pairwise a number entanglement.
Maybe it's a question of
terminology, but that describes the classical gross potential equations.
Yeah.
And in that sense, there's no entanglement. So I'm just curious in your last question.
Well, we have, so to say, two atom correlations that should exist in this. Well, and two atom correlations is, well, it's the same way classical as any four-wave mixing is classical in optics.
But entangled in the sense of quantum
theory, that's what. Yes. Oh, I fully agree. I mean, this is not in a single quantum gate where you can separate out your qubits. This is for sure. It's a rather complicated correlation within the system.
I think Subir have asked an important question. I think there may be miscommunication of language. As Krauss have said, if you look at the equation again, then it's very easy. Just by inspection, you realize that if we'd have 100% of atoms in the zero state, then the classical equation tells you there's no evolution. And that's why Krauss said that he has to put a seed in the system, because it goes through very fast. Yes. And the experiment is done and analyzed in the following way. They did many, many times praying, and most likely it would happen. Every time you have maybe 3, 5, maybe 10, some up and down in there. And they do a lot of average, and that's how they get all these curves. Now, one could do a calculation with entirely quantum mechanical, that just take the initial state quantum mechanical, then the system would evolve, and then actually you would discover it evolved in a way actually quite similar to some of these. Now, then the question is, how can I distinguish whether the quantum or... I think the only way you can distinguish, which is to measure correlation between particle difference in both theory components, and then come down to the long noise level, and then I hope that Mike could address that. I think that is a really important issue, whether the whole thing is evolving quantum non-classically or classically.
Yeah, but then you have to really measure sub-shot noisily. Then you have to measure really sub... short noise.
I think it's good that we will have grand challenges for our experimentalist friends.
I think it's something similar here. Of course, you can find a certain test space.
Well, perhaps a comment on this also. This was very much studied, but it was studied in detail by Ignazio Serac-Pitazzola in a publication calculating out the amount of entanglement in these spin systems if you optimize this procedure. And you get a certain amount of entanglement depending on your parameter space.